Greetings, Israelite family. Welcome to Word Study with Brother Hebert. This is part 13 of Devil, Satan, Serpent. You can follow along with the article by going to www.thinkoutsidethebeast.com. Devil, Satan, Serpent can be found on the main menu. In part 12, we saw that from Numbers to 1 Kings, the word Satan simply means adversary and refers to anyone who opposes someone, God, or kingdom. Whether it's the angel of Yahweh standing against Balaam, the rival wife Peninnah provoking Hannah, David being seen as a threat by the Philistines, God raising up opponents like Hadad and Rezon against Solomon, and even God himself. These examples show that Satan is not a supernatural evil being, but a role of opposition used for people, messengers, or nations. Now let's examine another hot topic. The sons of God. The phrase, the sons of God, Ben Elohim, appears in several biblical contexts, including Genesis 6, Job 1:6, Job 2:1, and Job 38:7. Who are the sons of God? Across the Bible, the phrase, sons of God, generally refers to God-fearing, redeemed Israelites in covenant relationship with their God. The Old Testament, Genesis 6. The sons of God are the God-fearing descendants of Adam, the Adamic line. They were those in covenant with Yahweh who eventually went astray and intermarried with the daughters of men, representing unrighteous or pagan individuals. Job 1:6 and Job 2:1. The sons of God are righteous people assembling before Yahweh God, a practice echoed in Christian assemblies, Hebrews 10:25. Other examples, 2 Chronicles 5:13 and 14. The people worshipped in unity, and God's glory filled the temple. Psalm 22:22. The righteous praise God in the congregation. Psalm 35:18. Thanksgiving is given in the great assembly. Psalm 111:1. The righteous gather to give thanks to the Lord. Joel 2:15 and 16. A solemn assembly is called for repentance and prayer. Matthew 18:20. Jesus promises his presence where two or three gather in his name. Acts 2:42-47. The early believers devoted themselves to teaching, fellowship, and breaking bread. Acts 4:31. The believers gathered to pray, and the place was shaken by the Spirit. Sons of God and similar phrasing also appear in Deuteronomy 32:28. God divided the nations and set the bounds according to the children of Israel. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint maintain sons of God. 2 Samuel 7:44, David and Solomon are sons of God. Psalm 29:1, give unto Yahweh, O you sons of the mighty. Psalm 82:6, you are gods, and all of you children of the Most High. Psalm 89:6 and 7, who among the sons of the mighty can be likened unto Yahweh? Matthew 5:9. Peacemakers are the children, or sons, of God. Hosea 1:10. Sons of the living God refers to redeemed people. Hosea 1:10.
Yet the number of the children of Yisrael shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered, and it shall come to pass, that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, you are the sons of the living God.
New Testament. Luke 3:38 confirms that Adam and his descendants were called sons of God. John 1:12. Believers are given authority to become sons of God. Romans 8:14-19. Those led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. Creation groans for the revealing of the sons of God. Galatians 3:26. Believers in Christ are sons of God through faith. 1 John 3:1-2. What immense love the Father has given us that we should be called sons of God. Let's cover Genesis 6 first. Genesis 6. The sons of God are humans, not angels. They represent the righteous line of Adam, who intermarried with unrighteous individuals, leading to moral corruption. The Nephilim, mentioned in Genesis 6:4 and Numbers 13:33, are identified as human tribes, example, the sons of Anak, and not the offspring of angels and humans. Genesis 6:1, And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. In the phrase Ha Adam Kalal, men began to multiply. Began is H2490 and means to profane, defile, pollute, desecrate, prostitute. The defiled lineage was increasing. Ezekiel 20 verse 9.
But I acted for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned before the eyes of the nations among whom they were, before whose eyes I had made myself known to them, to bring them out of the land of Mitzrayim.
The sin of Genesis 6:2. The sons of God, Seth's line, took wives from the daughters of men, Cain's line, leading to spiritual corruption. This parallels later biblical prohibitions against intermarrying with ungodly nations, Deuteronomy 7:3, Ezra 10:2, and 2 Corinthians 6:14. Verse 3, And Yahweh said,
My spirit shall not always abide with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years.
There were giants, Nephilim, in the earth those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. There were giants, men so called partly for their high stature, but principally for their great strength and force, whereby they oppressed and tyrannized over others. The last part of verse 4 in the Hebrew reads, Bear children by them, which were the powerful warriors of that time, men of authority. Giants is H5303, Nephil, a feller, that is a bully or tyrant. Related word H5307, Nafal, means to be inferior to. Men so called partly for their high stature, but principally for their great strength and force, whereby they oppressed and tyrannized over others. Mighty men and men of renown. Who were they? The Bible uses similar terms elsewhere for strong and infamous men, not supernatural hybrids. 1 Samuel 17, Goliath was a mighty man among the Philistines, yet entirely human. Numbers 13:33, And there we saw the giants, H5303, Nephilim, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight, Genesis 6:4. Numbers 13, The Canaanites were men of great stature, yet simply a powerful people. We were in our own sight as grasshoppers. Thus, their fear magnified these sons of Anak above measure, so that in comparison of them they thought themselves as weak and contemptible as insignificant insects. And so we were in their sight, in hyperbole, signifying that the Anakims looked down upon them with the utmost contempt. Deuteronomy 9:2, A people great and tall, the children of the Anakims, who you know, and of whom you have heard say, Who can stand before the children of Anak? In the Old Testament, sons of God is a moniker, meaning a signature or a name, denoting belonging to God rather than a term exclusive to angels. Passages like Deuteronomy 14:1, You are the sons of the Lord your God, indicate that Adam kind can be referred to in this way. The New Testament continues this theme, calling believers children of God, Romans 8:14, 2 Corinthians 6:18. Since sons of God consistently refers to those in God's favor, it would be inconsistent to apply it to fallen angels. Job was a real person. Either the Jobab, mentioned in Genesis 10:26 through 29, or more likely the Job mentioned in Genesis 46:13, a son of Issachar, and Ezekiel 14:14, alongside Noah and Daniel as an example of righteousness. Job, the latter, likely lived in Edomite territory, Uz, as suggested in Lamentations 4:21. The narrative's dialogue and structure, Job's poetic speeches and exchanges, suggest significant artistic embellishment rather than exact verbatim accounts of events. The prologue, Job 1 and 2, and epilogue, Job 42, are written in prose, providing a framework for the story. The central chapters, filled with poetic dialogues, are seen as dramatic interpretations rather than literal conversations. The text resembles a stage play, with characters like Job, his friends, and God engaging in stylized dialogue intentionally crafted to elevate the story. The Book of Job provides the most extensive use of the term Satan in the Old Testament, appearing 14 times out of the 19. It should never be capitalized. God did not literally chat with an adversary, often mistranslated as Satan, but that the narrative uses this interaction as a dramatized device to illustrate God's sovereignty and Job's testing. The meaning of Ha-Satan. In Hebrew, Ha-Satan, Strong's H7854, literally translates to the adversary, or the enemy, with Ha, meaning the. The term refers to a role or function, not a proper name or supernatural being. Synonyms in Hebrew, Zah, H6862, adversary or enemy, as used in Job 16, 9-14. Avil, H5760, ungodly man, a singular masculine noun describing the adversary in Job 16:11. Job 1:6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan came also among them. The sons of God are righteous believers assembling before Yahweh, not a gathering of angels or fallen beings. Biblical support. Psalm 107:32. Let them exalt him in the assembly of the people. Hebrews 10:25. Do not forsake the assembly of the brethren. Hebrews 2:12. I will declare your name to my brothers in the assembly. This phrase, presenting themselves before the Lord, is commonly used to describe the gathering of Israel's elders, priests, and people at the tabernacle or temple. Joshua 24:1. And they presented themselves before God. Judges 20:26. The people gathered before the Lord. Jeremiah 36:9. They proclaimed a fast before the Lord to all the people in Jerusalem. The Satan infiltrates this assembly, appearing as an outsider pretending to belong among the righteous. Zechariah's parallel. Job 1, 6-12 shares similarities with Zechariah 3, where Satan acts as an accuser against the high priest Joshua. Verse 7, And Yahweh said unto Satan,
From where do you come?
Then Satan answered Yahweh and said, From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And Yahweh said unto Satan,
Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil?
Then Satan answered Yahweh and said, Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made an hedge about him, and about his house, and about all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth your hand now, and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. This Satan is saying that Job is a fair-weather believer, that Job's righteousness is conditional. This adversary challenges Job's integrity, accusing him of fearing God only because of his blessings. Yahweh permits the Satan to test Job within strict limits, Job 1:12 and 2:6, leading to Job's immense suffering. Loss of property, family, and health. Physical affliction, described as boils, possibly a form of leprosy. Comparison to Abraham and Isaac. The phrase, "put not forth your hand," echoes Genesis 22:12, where Abraham is told not to harm Isaac. This suggests Job's trial is a test of faith similar to Abraham's. Connection to Hezekiah? Some interpretations suggest that Job represents King Hezekiah, and Satan's role mirrors the Assyrian threat against Judah. Verse 12, "And Yahweh said unto Satan,
Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself put not forth your hand."
So Satan went forth from the presence of Yahweh. This Satan did not have any special power, but to convince and confound him and to try the grace of Job, that he might shine as an example. But our God did it for his own glory, for the honor of Job, for the explanation of providence and the encouragement of his afflicted people in all ages. God's hedge of protection. Isaiah 5:5.
"And now go to, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down."
This verse shows what happens when God removes his hedge of protection, allowing judgment or destruction to come upon his people. Zechariah 2:5,
"For I, says Yahweh, will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her."
God promises to be a protective wall of fire around his people, ensuring their safety. Parallel challenges of faith by individuals or rulers of nations. There are several verses where a person's faith is challenged under the accusation that they only serve God for personal gain or out of self-interest. These passages mirror the Satan's challenge in Job 1, 9-11, questioning whether someone's devotion to God is truly sincere. Abraham's test, Genesis 22, 1-12. Key verse, Genesis 22:12, "And he said,
Lay not your hand upon the lad, neither do you anything unto him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me."
Challenge: does Abraham serve God only because of his blessings? Test: God commands Abraham to sacrifice Isaac to prove his faithfulness, even if it costs him his dearest blessing. Connection to Job: like Job, Abraham had to show he served God without expectation of reward. Israel's complaints in the wilderness, Exodus 16:3, Numbers 11:4-6. Key verse, Exodus 16:3, "And the children of Israel said unto them, Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Challenge: the Israelites followed God out of Egypt, but only when life was good. Test: when suffering came, they questioned God's goodness and longed for Egypt. Connection to Job: like Satan's challenge, This shows how people may serve God only when life is easy. The Israelites wanted a king. 1 Samuel 8, 4-7. Key verse, 1 Samuel 8:7. And the Lord said unto Samuel,
Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them.
Challenge. Do the Israelites trust God, or do they only follow him for protection? Test. When they felt insecure, they demanded a king, rejecting God's rule. Connection to Job. Like Job's test, this reveals whether people trust God when they don't see immediate benefits. Hezekiah's faith challenged by Sennacherib's envoy. 2 Kings 18:28-35. Key verse, 2 Kings 18:30. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, The Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Challenge. Will Hezekiah and the people of Judah trust God for deliverance, or will they surrender out of fear? Test. The Assyrian commander Rabshakeh mocks Judah's faith, claiming that God cannot save them from the might of Assyria, comparing him to the false gods of defeated nations. Connection to Job. Like Job, Hezekiah was taunted with the idea that his faith in God was futile. Job's friends doubted his righteousness, and Rabshakeh doubted God's power. Both men stood firm in their trust despite outside voices trying to shake them. Nehemiah's test. Accusations by Sanballat and Tobiah. Nehemiah 4, 1-3 and 6, 5-9. Key verses. Nehemiah 4:2. What do these feeble Judahites? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? Challenge. Will Nehemiah and the Judahites stay faithful to their mission of rebuilding Jerusalem despite mockery, false accusations, and threats? Test. Sanballat and Tobiah spread lies, ridicule, and intimidation to shake Nehemiah's confidence and make the people doubt their success. Connection to Job. Like Job, Nehemiah faced slander and opposition designed to make him question his faithfulness to God's calling. Both remained steadfast despite external pressure. The temptation of Jesus, Matthew 4, 3-10. Key verse, Matthew 4, 9-10. And said unto him, All these things will I give you, if you will fall down and worship me. Then said Jesus unto him, Get you hence, Satan, for it is written, You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Challenge. Will Jesus remain faithful if he lacks food, safety, or power? Test. Satan tempts Jesus to serve God only for material benefits, food, protection, and kingdoms. Connection to Job. Satan implies faithfulness depends on blessings, just as he did with Job. The parable of the sower, Matthew 13:20-21. Key verse, Matthew 13:21. Yet he has not root in himself, but endures for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the word, by and by he is offended. Challenge. Do people serve God only when it's easy? Test. Some receive the word joyfully, but fall away when trials come. Connection to Job. This parable describes people who serve God conditionally, just as Satan accused Job of doing. The rich young ruler, Mark 10:17-22. Key verse, Mark 10:21-22. Then Jesus, beholding him, loved him, and said unto him, One thing you lack, go thy way, sell whatever you have, and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven. And come, Take up the cross and follow me. And he was sad at that saying, and went away grieved, for he had great possessions. Challenge. Will this man follow Jesus if it costs him everything? Test. Jesus tells him to give up his wealth, exposing that his faith depends on his riches. Connection to Job. Job lost everything but remained faithful, while the rich ruler refused to surrender his wealth. Peter's declaration and later denial. Luke 22:31-34 and 54-62. Key verse. Luke 22:31. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. Challenge. Will Peter still follow Jesus when it brings suffering? Test. Peter boldly proclaims loyalty, but later denies Jesus 3 times under pressure. Connection to Job. Satan sifts Peter, testing whether his faith is genuine under trials. The blind man's parents, fearful of confessing Jesus Christ, John 9:18-23. Key verses, John 9:22. These words spake his parents, because they feared the Jews. For the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ, he should be put out of the synagogue. Challenge. Will the blind man's parents acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah, or will they prioritize social acceptance and fear of being cast out? Test. The Pharisees pressure them to deny Christ, using religious and social threats to silence their testimony. Connection to Job. Unlike Job, who remained faithful despite losing everything, the blind man's parents feared consequences and avoided fully standing for the truth. Job suffered openly, while they tried to avoid suffering by remaining silent. And Satan entering Judas, John 13:2 and Luke 22:3-6. Key verse, Luke 22:3-6. Then entered Satan into Judas, named Iscariot, being of the number of the 12, and he went his way and communed with the chief priests and captains, how he might betray him unto them. Challenge. Judas followed Jesus, but was it out of true faith or self-interest? Test. When Jesus' kingdom didn't bring political power, Judas betrayed him. Connection to Job. Judas' loyalty depended on worldly benefits, similar to what Satan accused Job of. Satan again accuses Job. Job 2:1. Again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan came also among them to present himself before Yahweh. This aligns with Psalm 82, a profound passage where God addresses issues of justice and the responsibilities of leaders. God's authority among the mighty, verse 1. God stands in the congregation of the mighty. He judges among the gods. Divine presence. God positions himself among earthly rulers, emphasizing his supreme authority over all powers. The term gods in the Hebrew Elohim here refers to human judges or leaders appointed to execute justice on behalf of God. Rebuke of unjust leaders, verses 2-4. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Condemnation of injustice. God reprimands leaders for their unfair judgments and favoritism towards the wicked. Leaders are commanded to uphold the rights of the marginalized, including the poor, orphans, and the oppressed. Consequences of ignorance, verse 5. They do not know, nor do they understand. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are unstable. Lack of insight. These unjust leaders are depicted as lacking true understanding, leading to societal instability. Mortality of the gods, verses 6 through 7. I said, "You are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High, but you shall die like men, and fall like one of the princes." Divine appointment. While leaders are called gods due to their roles, they are reminded of their mortality and accountability. Jesus cites this passage, Psalms, in John 10:34-36, to highlight that if human judges can be called gods, his claim to be the Son of God is even more justified. Plea for divine justice, verse 8. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all nations. Psalm 82 serves as a powerful reminder of the responsibilities entrusted to leaders and the divine expectation of justice and righteousness. It underscores that all authority is accountable to God, the supreme judge. Job 2:2, and Yahweh said unto Satan,
"From whence come you?"
And Satan answered Yahweh and said, "From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it." The Satan claims to have been going around the land and walking up and down in it, presenting himself as a vagrant or wanderer, a cursed figure associated with lawlessness. Hosea 9:17, "My God will cast them away, because they did not hearken unto him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations." Deuteronomy 28:36, "The Lord shall bring you, and your king which you shall set over you, unto a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there shall you serve other gods, wood and stone." His actions and behavior suggest jealousy, hatred, and malice toward Job, motivated by Job's prosperity and righteousness. Verse 3, "And Yahweh said unto the Satan,
Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil? And still he holds fast his integrity, although you move me against him to destroy him without a cause."
And the Satan answered Yahweh and said, "Skin for skin, yea, all that a man has will he give for his life. But put forth your hand now, and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." And Yahweh said unto the Satan,
"Behold, he is in your hand, but save his life."
So went Satan forth from the presence of Yahweh, and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. Boils and suffering. Job is struck with loathsome sores from head to toe. Scholars debate whether these sores are literal or symbolic of a broader social and spiritual affliction. Symbolism of suffering. Some interpretations compare Job's suffering to the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, emphasizing his role as a righteous sufferer. Like Job, the suffering servant, Jesus, endures pain, rejection, and unjust suffering. Both figures suffer despite being innocent, demonstrating faith in God. Others connect his affliction to Assyrian conquests, where invasion and destruction were described as a plague upon a nation. Invasion and destruction as plague, Nahum 3:19. Connection to Job. Assyrian invasions were described as an incurable plague, a national affliction like Job's personal suffering. Both symbolize devastation, helplessness, and judgment. Boils as judgment. Exodus 9:9-11, the plague of Egypt. Connection to Job. Like Job's sores, boils in Egypt were a sign of divine affliction. Job's suffering is personal, while Egypt's boils represent national judgment. The ultimate restoration, Revelation 21:4, connection to Job. Just as Job's suffering ends with restoration, Job 42:10-17, Revelation promises a future where all suffering is erased. The affliction of boils, disease, and sorrow will be no more. Key takeaway. In Job, Satan acts as an accuser or adversary but lacks independent power. God explicitly states,
"You moved me against him to destroy him without cause,"
affirming his control over all events. God said he did the destroying. As the events unfold later on in chapter 19:6-13, we find that Job says that God caused all these calamities. He is trying to point out to these men that it wasn't necessarily any sin of his own, that they should understand that God did it. Job 19:21, "Have pity on me, have pity on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has touched me." This might seem out of place and off topic, but I chose to put it here to show that there is a divine order and structure for being in the presence of authority when gathered in congregations before the Lord. This should also answer the question about fallen angels and the woman's head covering. But what about 1 Corinthians 11:10? "For this cause ought the woman to have power on her head because of the angels." Paul is discussing the proper order of headship and authority in worship, particularly regarding a woman's head covering as a sign of submission to divine order. Meaning of power on her head. The phrase "power on her head" is widely understood as a sign of authority, submission, or modesty. This signifies that a woman ought to have a covering on her head as a sign of being under authority to her husband. It is a symbol of the authority under which she is placed, consistent with cultural customs at the time. This covering is not merely customary, but a divine ordinance reflecting the natural and divine order of headship. It is a voluntary acknowledgement of the headship of man, not an oppressive symbol, but a recognition of proper roles. The phrase metonymically represents authority, indicating that the woman acknowledges her divinely assigned role. Cross-references, Genesis 2:21-23, "Eve was taken out of Adam," highlighting their interrelationship. Ephesians 5:22-24, Paul teaches submission within marriage as a reflection of Christ and the church. Revelation 12:1, a woman is depicted with a covering of heavenly glory, linking to biblical imagery of head coverings. Interpretation of "because of the angels." Angels as a reference to fallen angels. Some suggest this refers to fallen angels, implying that modesty and proper order protect women from temptation. This interpretation is less likely, as it does not fit the immediate context. Angels as observers of worship. Angels are often depicted as witnesses to human conduct. Ecclesial order reflects heavenly order, and angels uphold God's structure. Cross-reference, Ecclesiastes 5:6, "Suffer not your mouth to cause your flesh to sin, neither say you before the angel that it was an error." Angels as participants in worship. The early church believed that angels were present during worship. Cross-reference, Isaiah 6:2, "The seraphim covered themselves in the presence of God," which mirrors the head-covering practice. Angels as enforcers of divine order. Angels executed judgments on those who defied God's structure. Example, Sodom and Gomorrah, Korah's rebellion. Some Jewish traditions taught that fallen angels were drawn to uncovered women, referencing Genesis 6:2. Angels as role models of submission. Angels submit to divine hierarchy, and women imitate this submission by covering their heads. Cross-reference Hebrews 1:14. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? Angels as messengers or church leaders. The term angels in the Greek can sometimes mean messengers or leaders of the church. Women should respect the authority of church leaders and demonstrate propriety in worship. Practical and theological implications. The head covering is a sign of modesty, order, and submission to God's authority. Paul teaches a divinely ordained order, not a cultural expectation. The head covering is a symbol of divine authority, not oppression. The presence of angels, messengers, assembly leaders, reminds believers that order and reverence in worship matter. Christian worship should mirror the order in heaven, where the angels are submissive to God's divine structure. The reappearance of the Satan in Job 16. Job's description of his enemy. In Job 16, 9-14, Job vividly describes an adversary who gnashes at him with his teeth, narrows his eyes in hatred, and strikes him, gathers to mock and attack him, is described as an ungodly man, Avil, and enemy, Zah. He teareth me in his wrath. The imagery of tearing is commonly used to describe military destruction in the prophets, Nahum 2:12, Amos 1:11, Micah 5:8. The Assyrian invasion is a historical parallel. The Assyrian tore at Judah, just as Job feels torn apart. Gnasheth upon me with his teeth aligns with Joel 1:6, which describes the enemy as having lion-like teeth. They have gapped upon me, meaning opened wide their mouths at me. Scholars connect this verse to the suffering servant of Isaiah. Job is presented as a righteous sufferer who is being mocked and struck upon the cheek. Some scholars link Job's experience to King Hezekiah, whose suffering mirrored the prophetic theme of a righteous ruler enduring affliction. God has delivered me to the ungodly. Job expresses the pain of feeling abandoned by God. Some interpret this as a reference to military conquest, with God allowing invaders to overtake the land, Isaiah 10, 5-6, where God allows Assyria to punish Judah. Others view this as Job being handed over to wicked men in society who take advantage of his misfortune. I was at ease, but he has broken me asunder. Job contrasts his former peace and stability with his current destruction. This aligns with Lamentations 1, 3-6, where the fall of Jerusalem is described in similar terms. The reference to being shaken apart reflects the overthrow of kings and kingdoms, a frequent theme in prophetic literature. His archers compass me round about. The archers could symbolize literal military attackers or metaphorical divine judgment. Biblical parallels, Jeremiah 50:29, archers surround a city as part of a siege. Isaiah 37:33, a prophecy against Sennacherib, describing an army besieging Jerusalem. Some scholars suggest this imagery reflects Job's internal agony, while others see it as a theological reflection on Israel's suffering. He breaks me with breach upon breach. The term breach upon breach is a military phrase used for the destruction of city walls in Isaiah 5:5 and 30:13. This aligns with Jerusalem's fall, where the enemy broke through the city's defenses. Job compares himself to a city under attack, reinforcing the siege imagery. This adversary's actions parallel those of the Satan in chapters 1 and 2, indicating that the Satan is a known human enemy. Actions against Job. The Satan orchestrates events leading to Job's suffering. Fire, strong winds, and attacks by the Sabians and Chaldeans destroy Job's possessions and family. Job's adversary also mocks and physically torments him, gathering others to join in his persecution. The narrative focuses on human suffering, opposition, and perseverance, not a cosmic battle between God and fallen angels. The Satan represents the envy, malice, and hostility that the righteous often face from others. Job's story illustrates the resilience of faith amid suffering and the ultimate vindication of the righteous. The phrase, sons of God, the Hebrew Ben Elohim, refers throughout Scripture to righteous, covenant-bound people, those in relationship with Yahweh. In Genesis 6, the sons of God were Adam's faithful descendants through Seth, who became corrupted by intermarrying with the ungodly children of Cain, leading to societal decline. This is not about fallen angels. The Nephilim were violent tyrants, not giant hybrids. We'll cover this later. In Job 1 and 2, the sons of God were righteous individuals assembling before Yahweh, much like the worshiping congregation seen throughout Scripture. The so-called Satan was simply an accuser among them, not a supernatural being. Across both testaments, sons of God refers to the faithful, Adam, Luke 3:38, Israel, Deuteronomy 14:1 and Hosea 1:10, David and Solomon, 2 Samuel 7, and all Israelites who walk in covenant and who are led by the Spirit, Romans 8:14, Galatians 3:26. From Genesis to Revelation, sons of God always means those who belong to God, not angels, not rebels, but His people Israel, walking in righteousness.
Let this mind be in you, which was also you, and the works that He did, I know we shall do again. Some will mock, criticize, but we don't mind these earthly trials. It will be worth it all when we hear the final call. Now are we the sons of God, though our trials have been hard, and it does not yet appear what we shall be. But we know appears in our heart, there'll be no fear. We'll be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. Now are we the heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ the King. If we suffer with the Lord, won't be long till we shall reign. So we'll walk on by faith, no matter what they say. It is worth every trial since we're on our last mile. Now are we the sons of God, though our trials have been hard, and it does not yet appear what we shall be. But we know when He appears, shall see him as he is. We're in the army of the Lord, marching on in one accord. We will not turn aside for worldly friends, flesh or pride. Marching on in Jesus' name, what he did, we'll do the same. While the battle rages on, we will sing this victory song. Now are we the sons of God, though our trials have been hard, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know when he appears, in our heart there'll be no fear. We'll be like him, for we shall see him as he is.